we have for oral argument is the McCoy versus Gray case. Mr. Kinsel, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. Court, please. Before getting into...
Excuse me, could I ask you to state your name for the record, please?
I apologize.
Sure.
My name's Jack Kinsel. I represent the plaintiffs on appeal. If the court please, the word sua sponte ring a bell in this case as well. On 2/11/09, in pretrial proceedings, the trial court sua sponte said, we are not going to consider the offer of the builder to fix this step by putting a wood edging on the step. We are not going to consider that at all. The defendants did not ask for it. It was not a scheduled part of the hearing. That was done. The record reads he did it because of the subsequently prepared doctrine. It probably was a transcription error, and it should have been subsequently repaired doctrine. The only problem with that is 4 months before Ms. McCoy fell on the solitary step, the builder went to Mr. Paddock, married to defendant Gray, and said, I will put a wood edging on the step so people can see it more easily because of the fall of a Ms. Christensen. And the judge said, no, without argument, without notice, you're not going to talk about that indication of danger. You're not going to talk about the fact of notice. You're not going to talk about it.
Can I interrupt you a moment? Let's assume we agree with you that the trial court made a number of errors in terms of the liability determinations here it made. You've asserted that the trial court erred in entering summary judgment for Mr. Pavic. You've asserted a number of other errors that relate to liability. Your opponents have raised, however, a contention that it is all harmless because the jury found no damages to your client. Could you address that for me, please? Because it seems to me like that's a threshold issue we need to get over before we decide whether we can look at your liability issues.
In the reply, well, first of all, not all issues are dependent upon, not all issues go away with a harmless argument. But secondly, and more importantly, in the reply brief, without knowing the name of the concept, I argued cumulative harmless error as well as structural error. And I want to just defer talking about those for just 1 second. I'll come right back to them. The other sua sponte order was without notice. You received on the deposition of Ms. Gray a claim of marital privilege. That's not going to be mentioned at all. That's not going to be brought up at all. It was as to whether her husband had talked with her about the offer to fix the step. Again, the same argument. It's a cumulative matter, and there are more errors to talk about concerning this.
I assume that there are a number of errors. That was the purpose of my question. Let's assume that there are a lot of liability errors. The same question nevertheless arises. How does it affect the case, given that the jury found your client didn't sustain any damages? And therefore, even if there are numerous errors, as you allege, how does that get us to the question of reversal and remand for a new trial?
There are two concepts. Structural error, and that
in a civil case, structural error?
There is no authority for it in Colorado. There is authority for it in other jurisdictions. As a matter of fact, it's a Vista case that Judge Webb wrote, I don't know how long ago, where he said, that hasn't been ruled on in Colorado yet. That's the cumulative harmless error as well as the structural error. But the structural error says, if you have bias in the judicial officer in the case, which we've alleged for a long period of time, including before the end of trial, if you have bias, the case is so infected that the harmless error doesn't count. It's just going to be reversed. And my argument to here today is that step by step, steps were taken that caused an infected trial to take place as opposed to a trial which was a fair proceeding. The first step that was taken early in the case, November 2007. The judge, sua sponte, called a case management conference. The conference was all about the judge's background with State Farm, Fire and Casualty, and law firms that he dealt with, that for 20 years he represented State Farm, Fire and Casualty. And no one objected to the judge's continuing at that point in time. The judge's disclosure was partial in that, and it only showed up in the record because the acoustics in that courtroom are terrible, as everyone noted. The judge said, well, there still is this, but I don't think it's a problem. And no one noticed it at the time. I didn't notice it until I was reading the transcript. I was surprised that it was picked up. Thereafter, the judge did the sua sponte rulings. There was also a ruling that said, the judge said, and it was a motion in limine where the defendants had the burden. The motion in limine was to prevent any mention of the fall of Ms. Christensen on the same step, roughly the same time of day, roughly the same lighting, that her fall on that single solitary step could not be mentioned. And that's why it was important for the judge to also take out on his own, the offer of the builder to fix that step.
Mr. Kinsel, is it your position that Judge McGahey, because of his prior representation of State Farm, is required to recuse himself from any case in which State Farm is involved directly or indirectly?
Judge, I have no idea. I can't answer that question. I haven't studied that question. All I know is that these are rulings sua sponte, three sua sponte so far, that materially took away danger, took away notice, took away the guts of a liability case. But let me tell you how the guts of a damages case was taken away. And that's not harmless error, because that goes to the issue of damages. What happened in the damages case is the judge said, Mr. Kinsel, you have to have a written assignment from the insurance company before you can put in these workers' compensation damages, because as it stands right now, they're not in the name of the plaintiff. I said, Judge, and this is another part of it. This happened on the morning of trial. We tried to get a full transcript. Four times we ordered a full transcript. And that's in the record, and I can provide the citation to it. We didn't get, and you still don't have, the transcript for the morning proceedings in which this took place. The judge said, do you have a written assignment? No, they won't provide it because of Jorgensen. The transcript, and the judge said, well, so much for that. And we were not able to prove up damages. We couldn't say the medical expenses were ours because the judge ruled they weren't. So we couldn't prove the medical expenses that were stipulated at $41,000. We couldn't prove that up.
There was a jury instruction telling the jury they should regard the plaintiff of having sustained $41,000 in damage.
Yes, there was a jury instruction that said that, but I couldn't get up and argue these are plaintiff's damages because the court had ruled we didn't have a proper assignment. And I didn't dare do it. It's a frustration. Let me talk briefly about the PAVIC summary judgment.
But before you get on to that, Mr. Kinsel, do you disagree with Judge McGahey's statement that you needed to get an assignment of the workers' compensation benefits in order to be able to recover them?
I do, because the statute was changed approximately, now it's about, time gets away, but approximately 10 years ago. The statute now says that the plaintiff brings the action unless within 90 days the insurance company intervenes. And the words elect to intervene are in the statute. And that same statute provides that there is no intervention, like there was not in this case, if there's no intervention, the plaintiff's counsel gets a one-third attorney's fees and costs as a result of the action. The statute should have been a lot clearer because of cases like Moore versus Fisher, but it wasn't. The insurance company said, hey, look, you don't have to have a written assignment. And we didn't get a written assignment. I wanted to say, what's the difference, insurance company? What's the big deal? I've got a judge who's already indicated this is the direction he's going. And he did on the morning of trial. And that's where we stood. As far as another damages argument, which is most important, is that the Schnabel case instruction was given, offered, rejected. That's all in the record. The record's made. It was tendered. It's marked, refused. That case says, look, you jurors, you have the power to say that the first accident caused this woman to, or contributed to this woman having a second accident. That goes to damage as well. The motion for change of judge goes to the damages as well. I'm into my moments, and I want to reserve 2 minutes and 18 seconds, please.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Kinsel.
Good morning. Michael Milstein, appearing on behalf of the appellees, Dr. Gray and Mr. Pavic. Your Honors, I intend to talk about three particular issues that were raised by the appellants in this case. There were a whole array of issues that were contained in the opening brief, but I'm going to focus on the Dunlap case, on the Pavic summary judgment, and on the exclusion of testimony from John Smith. I think that the most critical component of this case is the fact that the jury was provided with a separate jury instruction that shows that there was a determination of the damages issue separate from liability. And under the Dunlap decision, that jury determination that the plaintiff has no damages makes the all of the alleged errors relating to the liability issues harmless. There isn't any case law in Colorado supporting these cumulative this cumulative error concept, and quite frankly, there aren't a whole host of liability errors that would warrant any sort of change in the law on that particular issue. So the Dunlap decision is dispositive.
Mr. Milstein, if I may interrupt you, Judge Casebolt referred to an instruction that was given to the jurors saying that there were $41,000 of medical expenses incurred. Why then, in your view, did the jury not award any damages?
I don't know if this will show up in the record, but I think there was a second accident, and I think the jury believed that any injuries that she sustained were related to that second accident.
Was that argued by trial counsel?
Yes.
Okay.
It should be in the record. So there were some questions as to whether the I think it was a separated shoulder that she allegedly sustained, but there was argument about how Ms. McCoy, after she fell, picked herself up, wiped off her skinned knee, picked up all of her heavy belongings, walked out to her car, lifted the hatchback door with her allegedly separated shoulder, and then came back the next day and was able to within a few business hours, send an email sending out pricing regarding these window coverings to Dr. Gray. So there were some questions about whether or not there was a legitimate injury sustained during the slip and fall. But suffice to say, the record's clear that the jury did in fact find that there were no damages.
And what is your view about Mr. Kinsel's point about the decision by Judge McGahey regarding an assignment or a lack of an assignment regarding the workers' comp damages or benefits?
I think Judge McGahey got that decision right, but it's moot because there was a stipulation between the parties prior to trial as to the amount of damages, and that stipulation ends any issues that may have been raised. There wasn't an offer of proof made that there were additional damages that the plaintiffs wanted to get in. So that I think that ends that.
I'm a little bit confused, and maybe you can clarify this. I thought that Mr. Kinsel was saying that the $41,000 in damages were as a result of workers' comp benefits that had been paid.
I think the stipulation was that the amount of damages that the plaintiff had, the dollar amount of the damages were stipulated to be $41,000. And my understanding is that stipulation was inclusive of all of her damages.
Including workers' comp benefits?
I don't think there was any sort of itemization made, but that was a stipulation and agreement made by the parties prior to trial as to the amount of her damages.
But then Mr. Kinsel said that it was on the morning of the trial that Judge McGahey said, well, you can't argue anything about workers' comp damages that your client has received because there hasn't been a formal assignment. Do you agree with that statement by Mr. Kinsel?
Your Honor, I don't have that particular aspect of the record committed to memory. I do know that that issue was extensively briefed by the parties prior to the morning of trial. I honestly don't recall if that's correct or not.
Thank you.
Pardon me, Mr. Milstein. First, was the stipulation submitted to the jury? Did they get that?
I believe, yes, there was an instruction as to the stipulated amount of damage.
And second, how do we know that this was, how can we rely on your assertion that this was for all the damages as opposed to this was additional to the $41,000 in workers' comp? Is there some place in the record we can see where it's clear that the stipulation was designed to take care of everything?
No, Your Honor. I think the court would have to just read that stipulation and interpret it based on its plain language. I don't think that there was an issue that was decided on the morning of trial. I can tell you that that was done because there was a mountain of documents that Mr. Kinsel wanted to admit to evidence to try and prove up damages. And in order to shorten the length of the trial, the parties entered into an agreement and stipulated to that amount. But I don't think that there is any sort of methodology that this court could employ to find a piece-by-piece basis to figure out exactly what the attorneys intended those damages to entail.
But my recollection is that the stipulation just referred to medical expenses. Is that consistent with your recollection?
I I can't recall if it was written that narrowly.
Or did I misunderstand you, or were you asserting that the stipulation covered all of the damages the plaintiffs were seeking in this case?
That stipulation, at least from the appellee's standpoint, was intended to cover all of the damages. There was no other offers made to us as to any additional, at least economic damages with respect to that particular stipulation.
But were there not non-economic damages that were also sought?
There were some non-economic damages that were sought, but I don't
okay, think- so then Mr. Kinsel and the plaintiffs were actually seeking more than $41,000 in damages.
Yeah, I think that was for loss of consortium and those sorts of things, pain and suffering. But those, I think the damages that Mr. Kinsel's talking about are related to economic damages.
Okay. Clarifying that.
And again, I think the Dunlap decision renders all of those issues moot because the jury did make a determination that there were no damages sustained by the plaintiff in connection with this particular slip and fall accident. The issue of the summary judgment on Mr. Pavick, Dr. Gray's husband, the question that really determines the propriety of that summary judgment is whether Pavick had a sufficient possessory interest to qualify as a landowner at the time of the accident. And based on the Master Clean decision and the Pearson decision, the key to making that determination is whether Mr. Pavick had possession with the intent to control the particular property when that accident occurred.
Why isn't that true of fact?
I think that is a factual issue, but I think that there wasn't competent evidence presenting a genuine factual dispute.
Isn't there evidence presented that he was the person who essentially said, I'm going to not fix this step 4 months before the plaintiff fell here?
Yes. Now, let me see if I can clarify that, Your Honor. There is evidence in the record of a conversation that occurred where the builder said, do you want me to put a wood nosing on this step? This is during the construction process. And Mr. Pavick said no. I think that shows an intent of control during the construction process, during the construction phase of the house, but he wasn't living there at the time. This is an accident that occurred 4 months later while the parties were living in the property, and there's no nexus between that particular aspect of the construction phase of the property to
someone who is not living there can make a control decision and it not affect whether they have control after they move in?
I think what you're talking about is one of the myriad of decisions that goes into the design and construction of the particular property. And I think what the case law on this issue is clear, and I'm glad that this is sort of an academic exercise, because I think the Dunlap makes this moot, because I don't think the Pearson decision and the Master Clean decision really help define a clear test as to for figuring out whether possession exists. The Master Clean decision does talk about the issue of having some control over the particular area of the property where the accident occurred, and it doesn't really talk about a temporal limitation on that, but I think one there is implied. There has to be some nexus between the possession of the person and its intent to control it with the particular accident.
Does that change every day?
I think it's really an interesting question. I think it depends. It's a facts and circumstances test, depending on the particular accident that occurred. Because
then, how is summary judgment appropriate under these circumstances when there's an issue for the jury to decide? Was he a landowner? Does he meet the definition of landowner?
But in order for that to happen, there has to be facts, a genuine issue of material fact presented to the trial court judge to show that there is an issue of fact for the jury. And in this case, the issues of fact that were presented were, in addition to the one that you just described, issues about landscaping the backyard, putting a clear coat of cement, clear coat over the garage floor, the family's children and lizard living in the property. I think all of those fall by the wayside. And really that one issue for whether Mr. Pavick had an intent to control the property focuses in on that particular fact pattern. And I think that incident 4 months earlier related to this particular accident doesn't create a genuine factual dispute because there isn't any nexus to the accident. Mr. Pavick isn't at the property. The owner of the property is present with Ms. McCoy. She's walking around the living room with Ms. McCoy. They're making decisions about which lights are going to be on, which lights are going to be off, which directions they're going to go. It's Dr. Gray who's allegedly distracting Ms. McCoy, diverting her attention away. There isn't any nexus between that particular day and that particular incident and Mr. Pavick's intent to control that one nuanced aspect of design when the property is being constructed 4 months earlier.
Mr. Milstein, with all due respect, it sounds like your position is that whenever a husband and wife live in a house that is in the name of only one of them, the other person really has to get up every morning, get out of bed and say, I hold a possessory interest in this property. Otherwise, that person could escape liability under the Premises Liability Act. Is that an overstatement on my part?
I think that's an overstatement. Again, that's why
I think not much.
What in your view, if you think that's an overstatement, then what in your view is necessary for a spouse in whose name property is not held, but who's residing on the property has to do in order to manifest a possessory interest in the property?
I think it's just some evidence of intent to control with respect to the particular facts and circumstances.
But that doesn't come from living in a home that is owned by your spouse?
No. Just living there, I don't think necessarily infers an intent to control. What if he was on vacation for 2 weeks?
And what if he wanted to move the salt shakers from one cabinet to another? I mean, really, don't you think that this is an unrealistic argument here? You're saying that a husband and wife, just because the property is titled in the spouse in the wife's name, the husband has no possessory interest in it whatsoever?
No. Possessory interest, yes. Not coupled with the intent to control. I think there has to be some, then the kids can be a landowner for that particular, then the kids are a landowner. Then aunt, if I have a guest staying in the house and I say, my house is your house, they're technically a landowner. That's why I think it's important that it is. I don't know what the black line test is.
Well, let's take your example. If Aunt Betty moves in and she moves a broom from one closet to another and the closet for some reason opens up when somebody's walking by and the broom falls out and trips somebody and she's been told, don't put that broom there. Liability on Aunt Betty?
She would be a landowner under the statute. But if Aunt Betty, I tell her if the same fact pattern, if she's upstairs sleeping in the bedroom and I'm like, make yourself at home and do whatever you want. My house is your house. And she's like, that's great. I can't wait for this vacation. And there's an accident in the living room where she had, there's no manifestation of any intent to control by Aunt Betty on that particular, during that particular time period. And I'm glad that this is an academic issue because I think this is a much tougher analysis, in large part because of you've got complicated facts, and I just don't think that there's a whole there isn't clear guidance from the case law. But again, this is an academic discussion because of the Dunlap decision. This is a clear liability issue. The jury came back with the decision that there was no damages in this case, so it really renders this particular issue moot for purposes of this case. And I see I just have a few seconds left, Your Honor, so I'm going to close now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mills.
We had 4 months later, no wood nosing had been put on the step that Mr. Pavick said should not be put on the step. In terms of the Schnabel instruction, it had to do with the second accident. In terms of the statements made about what happened on the morning of March the 9th, the stipulation. It would be nice if this were a portion of the record. I requested it 4 times, never made it in the record. Everything that went in there. The jury instruction, as I recall it, and I don't have it with me, indicates a bland instruction that the medical expenses totaled $41,000. It didn't say to whom that should be payable. What happened when we had that mistake on whether there had to be a written assignment, here's what the juror said, and this is in the record, B2-2631. Were there any other sources of income considered when the zero current income was determined, Social Security, disability insurance, insurance. You know, it's easy for the jurors to say there was no damages because it was workers' comp was all over the courtroom. Inadvertently, Social Security was all over the courtroom. It was easy to say that there had been no damages and there was no protective instruction given by the court. And at that point, one couldn't even be requested because things were so messed up. We didn't even have a trial management order. And I tried and tried, and there was a morning in there when that could have happened. Yes, there are numerous errors alleged. Yes, there's an all-encompassing mistrial motion at the end. At the end, a motion for change of judge. All of these things. But every one of those events of February the 11th, 2009 were wrong. And then John Smith, poor John Smith, he's got two masters. He's got a master's in electrical engineering, and he wasn't able to be competent enough, according to the judge, to make a determination about a law of physics. And that is, when you're approaching a solitary step from a certain angle and certain lighting, you don't see the full picture.
Mr. Kinsel, your time is up.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Kinsel. Again, thank you, Mr. Milstein. We appreciate both of your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.